This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Dr. Drew Shendel, a climate scientist at NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies and Columbia University's Earth Institute. Drew Shendel is here today to discuss his article titled "Simultaneously Mitigating Near-Term Climate Change and Improving Human Health and Food Security," published in the January 13, 2012 edition of the journal Science. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Most of the efforts to reduce global warming have focused on reducing carbon emissions. In your science paper, you look at the potential of reducing methane and black carbon or soot to mitigate climate change. Why have you chosen to evaluate reductions in methane and soot as a way to lessen global warming?
Well, we particularly chose these pollutants because soot directly affects human health, and methane is one of the most important precursors of tropospheric ozone, so ozone in the lower atmosphere as opposed to up in the stratosphere. And ozone down at low levels is toxic both to humans and to many ecosystems. So these really, I think, deserve a kind of separate research from efforts to control CO2, because CO2, of course, has profound effects on the Earth's climate, but it doesn't also have these effects on air quality.
Would you explain how methane affects climate change?
So methane both directly affects climate change because it's a very powerful greenhouse gas. It's much more powerful pound for pound than CO2. And the other thing that it does that's important for climate change is it leads to ozone formation. And ozone is fairly short-lived in the atmosphere, a matter of weeks to months. But ozone is also a powerful greenhouse gas. So you get both a direct impact from methane behaving as a greenhouse gas and a secondary impact when methane leads to ozone formation, giving it an additional powerful impact on warming, as well as the impact that I mentioned before on human health and on ecosystem health.
And how does soot affect climate change?
Well, soot is more complex, and soot absorbs sunlight. So when you have an actual real-world source of soot, it comes from incomplete burning, incomplete combustion processes. So something that's extremely efficient, like a very, very high-temperature coal-fired power plant, is burning its fuel so efficiently that it emits very, very little soot. Soot primarily comes from things like household fires in the developing world for cooking and heating, or burning agricultural waste, things of that nature. And these kind of combustion processes give off all kinds of different particulate. Some of that particulate is very black, and which we call soot, and that is black because it's absorbing sunlight. But there's also particulate that's lighter colored and reflective and reflecting sunlight. Soot is the part that, since it absorbs sunlight, leads to warming of the climate.
Would you elaborate on how long methane and soot stay in the upper atmosphere compared to carbon dioxide?
Yes, well, carbon dioxide has a very long residence time in the atmosphere. That is, there's a portion of it that only lasts a couple decades because it's exchanged with, say, the upper layers of the ocean or the biosphere. But a portion of the carbon dioxide that we've emitted since the Industrial Revolution will be there for centuries and even millennia. In contrast, methane has a residence time in the atmosphere of only just a little over a decade. And ozone has a residence time of only weeks to months. Soot is removed even more quickly because it's actually removed by things like rainfall, unlike the others. Soot is soluble, so it can get absorbed into cloud particles and come out in the rain, and so its lifetime can be as little as a few days to a week or so.
And what are the implications for being able to lessen global warming?
Well, the implications then are if we try to control CO2, given that it takes a long time to respond in the atmosphere, and also given that much of the infrastructure that leads to CO2 emissions is very capital intensive, things like very, very expensive power plants built to last for many decades. You know, it's implausible to think that CO2 emissions will drop dramatically within a decade. There's no realistic scenario out there that foresees changes on that kind of time scale. It's much more on the time scale of, say, 50 years, over which current infrastructure is likely to be replaced. Then when you allow for the atmosphere to respond to that, you're talking about really seeing the effects of carbon dioxide emissions later in the century. So on the one hand, that implies that we can't do anything about climate in the near term by reducing carbon dioxide. But it also says that since it takes a long time, that we really have to reduce carbon dioxide now, even to get those benefits in the latter part of the century, because it's just so slow in responding. And I think that's one of the really interesting messages about black carbon and methane controls, is that they really have an effect, since they last in the atmosphere so much less time than carbon dioxide. They really have an effect on climate over the next few decades, but they don't really have this profound effect on climate in the distant future. So in order to deal with one problem, namely climate change in the long term, you really have to target CO2. But if you also want to make a difference in climate change in the near term, which is, of course, affecting people right now, then you really can't do that via carbon dioxide, but you can do that via controls on methane and black carbon emissions.
Well, you chose methane and black carbon or soot because of their health effects in addition to the effects on climate change. Would you say more about the health effects of these two substances?
So not only do these have this effect we've just been talking about on reducing warming in the near term, the next 2 to 4 decades, but they have effects on human health that are even more rapid, especially the human health effects from black carbon. And both ozone and small particulate matter, small because it gets inhaled very deeply in the lungs where it can cause more damage, have a lot of adverse consequences like cardiovascular disease, lung cancer, and the number of premature mortalities caused by current levels of ozone and small particulate matter is up in the millions every year. So reducing emissions, especially of black carbon, since it only is lasting for days to weeks, you know, by the end of a week, you start to see the health benefits. It's really as immediate as you could wish for. And the health benefits are pretty profound. So we looked at a series of measures that used existing technology that didn't require massive changes in behavior, didn't require inventing something new, but really implementation, very widespread implementation of technologies that are proven to work but have thus far been applied only in small areas of the world. And you could save anywhere from about 700,000 to a few million lives per year, the majority of those due to reductions in particulate matter. So these really have very powerful effects on health as well as the effects on climate. And again, that's really a different thing than carbon dioxide reductions.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Dr. Drew Schindel, climate scientist at NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies and co-author of the report, Simultaneously Mitigating Near-Term Climate Change and Improving Human Health and Food Security. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Well, you've alluded a bit to this, but would you say more about how you went about evaluating the potential of methane and soot reductions to mitigate warming and improve air quality? What was your approach?
Sure. It really was a very interesting project to work on because it involved scientists from both a lot of different parts of the world and from a lot of different backgrounds. And so it was a series of steps where at first there is a European-wide institute in Austria called the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis, where they study all kinds of complex systems processes. And one of them are emissions to the atmosphere. And so they have compiled a database looking at literally hundreds and hundreds of different air quality measures and technologies that have been applied somewhere in the world. And people have taken measurements of what effects those have on emissions. So things from putting filters on diesel trucks to installing methane capture devices at landfills, like you have in King County in Seattle. They have this database then of things that actually have been tried and work, and we know what the results are. We put those together with current emissions around the world, and then looked at the effects on emissions if we applied those similar technological measures to all of the different places around the world where there are related emissions. So there are things like emissions from livestock that we really do not have the technology to deal with. Livestock emit a fair amount of methane. We don't know how to control that. So that wasn't included in our study. But things that we could include, we found were able to reduce methane by about 40%, and that we had current technologies that could reduce soot emissions by about 75%. So with these databases then on the results on the emissions, we took those and put them into two different composition and climate models, so large models used in research like IPCC assessments, one developed in Europe and one developed here in the United States at NASA. And we used those models to analyze what the effects of these emissions reductions would be on concentrations in the atmosphere and what that would do to climate and what that would do to surface level pollution. Then we took the surface level pollution and passed those results to yet two more teams of researchers, one in Europe that looked at the effects of ozone concentrations at the surface on agriculture. Ozone is toxic to many plants and reduces crop yield, as well as damaging natural ecosystems. But we, in particular, looked at the effects on four staple crops that we had good data for how they responded to ozone. And then researchers here in the United States, based at the Environmental Protection Agency, took the surface concentration changes in particulate and in ozone and calculated the effects on human health. We also then even had an economist who then put a price on all of the benefits, and the group back in Austria that had developed the emissions control database put a price on the cost, so we were able to compare the costs with the benefits on the same economic scale. So it was a very long and involved process with a lot of different groups, a lot of input, but eventually it all came together.
Well, you've alluded to your findings, but would you just summarize the overall finding, the most important elements of it?
So I'd say the most important elements are that using the existing technologies, if we were to implement these rapidly and around the world, we could realize three very distinct and valuable benefits. One would be to substantially slow the rate of warming over the next few decades. So instead of warming more than a degree over the next few decades, we would cut off about half a degree of that warming and warm substantially less than a degree. Since we've already warmed about 8/10 of a degree and we're trying to keep below 2 degrees, this is all in Celsius, we really don't have that much farther to go. So that half a degree sounds like a small number, but it's pretty important. It can also prevent various species that might be extinct by 2040 or so. So if we let things go on as they are. So there's this profound near-term climate benefit. At the same time, roughly 1 to 4 million lives per year saved by the human health benefits of controlling these emissions. And at the same time, the benefits to agriculture, just looking at four staple grains grown around the world, are roughly 30 to 130 million tons of additional food produced every year. So when you put these all together and place an economic value on them, you find that the value to society as a whole of these benefits put together tends to dramatically outweigh the costs.
According to your computer models, which parts of the world or countries will benefit the most overall from the mitigation measures to reduce methane and soot?
Well, that's an interesting question, and it really depends on the measure and the impact. So for the methane measures, given that methane lasts long enough to be mixed throughout the atmosphere by the winds, the benefits tend to be fairly uniform, and regardless of where the methane emissions reductions are put into place, the whole world tends to benefit fairly similarly. What's different is with the black carbon measures. Those affect, as I've mentioned, black carbon, also other particulate, and also some other ozone precursors. And so the benefits of those tend to be found much more local to the regions where the emissions controls are put into place. And so since the particulate has the strongest impact on health, the health benefits tend to be greatest in countries in Asia and Africa, where the emissions are currently very, very large, especially from residential cooking and heating. Also from diesel vehicles, as the pollution controls are not up to the standards currently in use in Europe and the United States. The same is true to some extent for regional rainfall changes, where those can be substantially disrupted by black carbon. So reducing the black carbon can tend to reduce climate change's impact on shifting the monsoon rains or rainfall in Africa, which can, of course, lead to drought and famine. And then the agricultural benefits are slightly different again, as they are a function of how much sunlight is available to produce ozone from the precursor emissions. And so those tend to be shifted towards sunny places, and the benefits are often largest in the Middle East. The final impact that I haven't really mentioned before is that soot has an extra strong impact on temperature when it falls on snow or ice surfaces, because those are typically, they would be white, or at least fairly white, depending on how dirty the snow is. And the white surface reflects sunlight, but as soot is deposited onto those surfaces, they get darker and absorb the sunlight instead of reflecting it, and the snow and ice begin to melt. So the one other area that would receive extra benefits for climate in terms of temperature would be the Arctic and places like the Himalayas.
How much will the United States benefit?
Well, the United States would realize a substantial reduction in warming. We would not see as large effects on rainfall or human health. Primarily, we would see, yes, reduction in warming, and we would see agricultural benefits too, because about half of those come from the methane measures. And since those are widespread, we would feel them as well as places where the emissions cuts are actually made. And given how much food we grow in the United States, in terms of the percent yield change, the United States doesn't stand out so much, but in terms of the total tonnage of food affected, the United States would be one of the largest beneficiaries in the world in terms of increased agricultural yield. So we would stand to gain a lot from encouraging these measures to take place, not just within our own borders, but around the world.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Dr. Drew Schindel, researcher at NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies and co-author of the report, Simultaneously Mitigating Near-Term Climate Change and Improving Human Health and Food Security. You've alluded a bit to this earlier, but let's focus on the specific mitigation measures that are most effective in both reducing climate change and increasing human health by reducing methane and black carbon or soot. Would you begin by speaking about the mitigation measures specific for methane?
So for methane, there are a series of measures that have these dual benefits for both climate and health. But the most important ones in terms of the real potential to reduce the emissions by a large amount are two broad areas. One is fossil fuel production. And within that, the main measures are capturing methane from coal mines. That's widely done in much of the world, but especially in China, coal mine methane is typically vented or flared off to the atmosphere rather than captured and used. And the other is oil production, where, again, methane isn't your target. And so when methane comes along with oil, it's, again, often vented or flared to the atmosphere rather than being captured or used. And one thing that's especially attractive about those kind of measures is that since you're in the fossil fuel business and capturing methane is a fossil fuel that you can then sell as the main component of natural gas, these measures can often pay for themselves. They can often pay for themselves even ignoring the climate and health benefits just based on the value of the captured product. So I think there's really very substantial room for progress there. The other largest category for methane emissions are municipal waste. And so there are plenty of places where there are methane capture devices installed on landfills. But preventing biodegradables from going into the waste stream in the first place is obviously one way to reduce waste emissions, but the other is more widespread installation of these methane capture devices at landfills. And again, those often pay for themselves, but in many places it's the upfront capital costs that prevent them from being put into place.
What are the most effective mitigation measures for black carbon or soot?
Well, they're the two specific largest emission sources are diesel vehicles and residential use of solid fuel. And so for diesel vehicles, unfortunately, this is one of the few cases where the emission control measures can sometimes be quite expensive. If you want to retrofit existing vehicles by putting on diesel particulate filters, this works very well, but it doesn't come cheap. So what we looked at even more was putting into place standards for new vehicles, and then as the fleet turns over and is replaced with cleaner vehicles, if they were to follow current American or European standards for emissions rather than those in place in most of the developing world now, that would really greatly reduce diesel emissions. And the other is replacing solid fuels. More than 3 billion people around the world still depend on solid fuel, be it agricultural residue, dung, wood, you know, whatever organic they can grab nearby that provides a source of fuel for cooking and heating is used. And this is done usually in the most inefficient way possible, things like a three-stone fire where you put the fuel on top and just burn it. And these are terrible for health, especially women and children that are inside the home. What we looked at was the effect of the pollutants once they're out into the atmosphere, and the effect of outdoor pollution on health. But the effect on indoor pollution would add millions more premature deaths every year from breathing in all the pollution that comes off. So there we looked at the impacts of replacing these traditional stoves with more modern clean-burning stoves, where you have a fairly simple stove that you simply operate at far more efficiently, and it reduces by far the fuel supply, the time required to gather fuel, etc. So there are manifold development benefits to that as well, reducing deforestation, etc. And the other option we looked at, since this is such a large source, was replacing the traditional cook stoves entirely with modern fuels. Now, that's much more of a challenge, but it has been done in West Africa, in Senegal, where all of the traditional cook stoves were basically eliminated through an effort of multiple government departments to both provide fuel and new cook stoves, and significantly to provide education on why these were better for people to use. You can't just drop in a stove and then leave, or people will immediately switch back to using wood that they can gather for free rather than buying things like propane. But if with a substantial education program at the same time for the health benefits, for how this is more efficient and therefore frees up time, which you can go to do something else and earn some money to pay for the fuel, you know, this can really work. But it's a challenge.
Well, there are a number of different mitigation measures, but overall, what are the challenges to implementation? What most stands in the way?
Well, I think one of the things that really stands in the way is a lack of appreciation of all of the different benefits. So some of these things are happening. In China, there are now diesel regulations in some of the big cities, and the same is true for India, but they're not really widespread. And, you know, probably eventually they will be. But you typically have, in most countries of the world, same in the developed world, you have one group of officials that are charged with air quality and one group of officials that are charged with climate, and they may not see the benefits of a strategy that deals with both simultaneously. If you just look at one aspect or the other, you wouldn't necessarily choose these particular measures. There are other things you can do, like controlling carbon dioxide, that have a more powerful effect on climate over the long term. There are other things you can do to improve air quality, but that would not give you these climate benefits. And so I think it's partially there's a divide within most of our institutions that isn't capable of bridging across these different impacts to see that it's good for agriculture. You know, that's controlled by a totally different set of officials than health or climate. Also, I mean, in some cases, as I alluded to before, it can be money. It can be startup money, even for things that pay for themselves, like many of the methane measures. A big city in the United States might have the money to install landfill capture and resale the methane and come out ahead. A big city in the developing world might not have the capital to put that equipment in the first place. And so there have been proposals for things like financing mechanisms, which would be really in the end quite cheap because these things generate a source of revenue, so they would pretty much pay back for themselves. But you need that upfront money to get things done. So I think it's a combination of barriers like that. And with the cook stoves, as I mentioned, that really is something where I think people, when they first started those efforts, didn't realize just how comprehensive an effort had to be. And they did do things like bring people stoves, bring people, you know, 1 month supply of fuel, go away, and after a month people would switch back and go chop down the nearby forest and use that instead because it was free. And they didn't really see how it was in their long-term interest to preserve the forest and to instead use the substitute fuels. So there's a lot of work to be done to do these. They're by no means easy, but hopefully recognition of all of the different benefits they provide can prompt people to elevate the priority of some of these measures.
What do you say to those who are concerned that focusing on methane and black carbon or soot will detract from efforts to reduce carbon dioxide emissions?
Well, I would say to them that I certainly understand where they're coming from, and I don't think that anything that we've demonstrated suggests less urgency to control CO2. As I mentioned at the beginning, you know, these controls on methane and black carbon really influence climate in the near term and only in the near term. While CO2 controls have almost no influence on climate in the near term, but are the whole story for the long term. And both of those things are important. But while there's, I suppose, some danger that people could decide they can only concentrate on one thing at a time, I mean, I don't think that's the way we behave as a society in most cases. And I think we are capable of targeting two separate problems at the same time. I think we do that all of the time. You know, we treat air quality as something to worry about, and we treat water quality as something to worry about, and we think climate change is something to worry about. And we don't say it's clean air or clean water. You know, we can divide our resources and put some towards both issues. And I think that's what really needs to be done here. We need to work on CO2 because it's a long-term problem. And we need to work on methane and soot because they're near-term climate problems and they're affecting health and agriculture. So I think there's good reason to deal with both of these.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I would like to leave people actually feeling kind of optimistic. You know, I've been working in climate change for a long time now, and virtually every scientific paper I publish tends to bring bad news about how the dangers are really bad and things look like they're going to get worse rather than better in the future. And it's actually a hard problem to deal with. It's hard to predict, so it makes it exactly what the consequences will be, making adaptation hard. You know, it's usually bad news, and this isn't like that. This is a case where, from a health point of view, from a food security point of view, even from an economic point of view, these are ways to mitigate climate change and make a dent in this problem. Not solve the whole problem, but make a big dent in it, especially during the near term, while at the same time giving us all kinds of other benefits. So I think it's a really positive and encouraging development.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You have just been listening to Dr. Drew Schindel, climate scientist at NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies and co-author of the report, Simultaneously Mitigating Near-Term Climate Change and Improving Human Health and Food Security, published in the January 13, 2012 edition of the journal Science. For more information, check on the web at www.giss.nasa.gov/staff/dschindel. Again, that's giss.nasa.gov/staff/dschindell. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.